Hi, everybody. This is Steve Savitsky. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today we have Rabbi Avraham Gordimer, who is a rabbinic coordinator at the Orthodox Union. Rabbi Gordimer, how are you today?
Good, thanks. How are you, Savitsky? How are you doing?
I am doing very, very well. And nice to talk to you again. Rabbi Gordimer is a very prolific writer and is very, very outspoken about a lot of Jewish issues.
Thank you.
And we have the good fortune that you wrote a very interesting article in the forthcoming Jewish Action, Reclaiming the Dignity of the Rabbinate. What in the world happened and what can be done? Okay, let's begin with something that you talk about in the article, which is probably, when you really look at it in the macro point of view, we're really doing pretty well, but unfortunately we have some bad situations and they've gotten all the publicity.
Mm-hmm, that's true. That's true, very much so. Even though, as I mentioned in the article, the rate of, not to defend it in any way, but the rate of rabbinic scandal involvement is minuscule percentage-wise compared to really any other profession out there, but still we're sensitive to, we expect the highest standards of the rabbinate, so therefore anything, especially these grievous cases we had recently, anything is going to totally send shockwaves through the community, and that's what's happened, and it's really become a major, major problem that needs the proper focus.
Right. So, whenever something goes bad, everybody knows about it. When something goes good, nobody knows about it. And you talk about the fact that, things have changed. And you quote the Gemara in Chagiga. It talks about Rav Elusha ben Avuya, the heretic. In my knowledge, unless you could correct me, but I don't remember a lot of articles, I don't remember a lot of things in the Gemara or other places that talk about, rabbis who were dishonest or immoral. Are there a lot of things like that?
Really, really almost none. There are cases in which maybe a rabbi did something that maybe gave the appearance of being dishonest or immoral, or he made a point about it, or there was a controversy about whether or not it does reach the boundary, but not in a bad way, but it's more just for the purpose of teaching than actual historical occurrence.
Right. So but there's no question that because of the publicity and because of the fact that there have been some pretty horrific cases, the rabbinate has really come under scrutiny. And you kind of, postulate that things have changed, that rabbis today are not doing exactly what rabbis were doing years ago. So maybe you want to elaborate on that.
Yeah, sure. There's really two aspects to this. On the one hand, the rabbinate itself was totally transformed from the way it was even a century, less than a century ago. Previously, the rabbi was a halachic decisor. He had other communal responsibilities, counseling people and so forth. And we have stories with great Hasidic rabbis and other people, rabbis counseling, mentoring people, mediating situations. But basically, being a halachic expert, halachic decisor, was the rabbi's role. The modern rabbinate in America, including the Orthodox rabbinate, of course, is very much a far cry from that. There is halachic, halachic authority involved in it, but really so much of it is the rabbi being a director, managing the synagogue, fundraising, being involved in political activism very often, promoting the synagogue, programming, so many different things that really totally redefine what the rabbinate's about. And what that creates, I think, is not only is it just the rabbi being spread thin and be burnt out, but he really is involved in a lot of things that he has exposure to the community in an unprecedented way, having information about private individuals, access to communal databases, all types of things that if a person has the wrong proclivities, he can do some pretty nasty things that really weren't available, weren't really in the radar many years ago. The second thing is that people, say, go into the rabbinate as a profession. In the old days, very few people went into the rabbinate as a career. A person was a Talmud Chacham, a scholar, and the community would seek a new rabbi. They'd maybe reach out to this rabbi. They go to a yeshiva. They send a board to or dignitaries to yeshiva to ask the yeshiva. They can send out a rabbi to serve their community. But really, no one went into the rabbinate, very rarely, I should say, as a profession, as a career. Say that's different. Say some people go into the rabbinate, some for teaching, some for kiruv, some for political reasons, and so forth. So therefore, there's a lot more room, both in what the rabbinate is as well as in people's involvement in it, for wrong things to occur.
So there was more of a selection process in the past. You were in yeshiva, you were learning in yeshiva, then perhaps the community picked you, but you didn't really take a rabbinic course and go for smicha, but you got smicha because you were there.
Exactly. Basically, the only exception, as I mentioned in the article, is the Berlin Hildesheimer Seminary,
right.
which was really founded to address the dire state of Orthodoxy in Germany in the 19th century. But that was an exceptional case. There they trained rabbis to reinvigorate Orthodoxy, to provide for the community and so forth. People went in because they realized the need. Other than that, though, you know, somebody being a rabbi was something that just happened because they needed him, not because he was seeking it or intending it or seeking it as a career.
Right, so you say you call the rabbi a super Jew, which is great, and but man, isn't one of the issues? I mean, also that you know, rabbi. I'm not saying he's one of the boys, but you know, I've seen a lot of that. That you know, more rabbis who are, you know, see themselves as friends. What should the relationship really be between the rabbi and the congregant?
It's really a very, very delicate balance. On the one hand, if the rabbi is not close to the congregants, if he's somebody who's aloof, he's like an ivory tower, he's going to be a failure. He won't help them. His career, if he's looking at it that way, is not going to really get too far. That's not the right thing. On the other hand, the other extreme, as I mentioned in the article, is the rabbi who's really one of the boys. If the men in the congregation have a, you know, like a guy's beer and bowling night, the rabbi's there. You see the rabbi maybe walking around with a, you know, sometimes on a, with a, in a way that you wouldn't know that he's a rabbi. It's in terms of his comportment, maybe his dress. That's not right either. There's something in between that in which the rabbi has to be very much involved, and involved in a mentoring way, in a positive way, in a rabbinical way, a dignified way. And I think that's a very tough balance to strike, but it has been done successfully, and we have to really focus on it.
So the rabbis, you have to walk a fine line, and it's a balance. And it's something that you develop over years. But, you know, I think one of the issues is that, as you said also, that the rabbi wants to make sure he still has a job. So in order to have the job, you've got to kind of be one of the boys or, you know, be able to tell some jokes and laugh with the people. Maybe that's allowed them to become a little bit too friendly. And maybe they should be a little bit more aloof from the congregants.
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't use the word aloof. I think that he has to be very much ma'ura, very integrated with them.
Right.
But in
okay.
a way in which his role is defined. Like, for example, sometimes you have a teacher coming into a class. I know that when I was in all the different schools I went to, whether it was in law school beforehand or whether it was in yeshiva, high school, whatever, in college, every teacher set the tone when they came into the room, whether the teacher was casual, formal, how you'd interact with the teacher, what the rules were, and so forth. So not the rabbi should be a lecturer and come in as a professor, but the rabbi does have the ability to set a certain tone, not a stiff tone, but a tone of comportment, of dignity with warmth and reaching out. And I think that is really in his hands to a good extent.
You're right. So, okay, at the more or less the second part of the article, when you talk about it, you then give some practical advice and you talk about the suggestions that you think we could do. If the article did say, you know, the article does say, enticing as it is, and what can be done. So we're going to try to find some solutions. And so you have a few. You call them narrow and elevate, rabbinic duties, narrow and elevate. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, and this really depends upon the community's resources and a lot of other issues and so forth, like everything here. But what I mean is that the rabbi's role, rather than the rabbi being spread so thin that he's involved in what I would call non-rabbinic functions for most of his day, actually, in certain cases, I know that's the case. He's involved in making the brochures and in planning the social events and in running the office and the computer programs and the website and fundraising and everything like that. And he also teaches some classes and he also gives a sermon. Rather than that, if possible, to narrow the rabbi's scope to primarily being a scope of teaching Torah, of being involved in a more purist, purely religious manner to the greatest extent possible. That way he's identified more as a Torah personality. And I think really if it's narrowed and defined that way in terms of his role, he's not going to be viewed as just one of the guys. Like he's the guy who runs the shul office and I'm the guy who runs my store or my business. The rabbi will have a different, more holy, public persona.
But isn't it also, we're trying to be practical here. So, I've seen it in communities that I've been to many times, you know, where there are rabbis, everybody knows they're acting somewhat inappropriate, and yet they get defended by other rabbis. And, where do you walk the line between don the kafschus and, you know, taking somebody on who you think is doing something wrong? Even after, by the way, there might even be an indictment. And even after the indictment, right away, it's, you know, no, you know, let's see what really happens and so on. And I'm not saying you have to, you know, not every single person is guilty, but, you know, if a rabbi has gotten to the point where there's talk and the newspapers are writing and there's an indictment and there are articles, I've seen too many rabbis, I think personally, then defend their colleagues and say, you know, I think we should give them another chance. We should this, we should that. And maybe that's taken away some of the credibility that Balabatim feel about the rabbis and their position.
I think that's a very good point. I agree 100%. Definitely. There is an idea of kafsuchus, of course, but however, though, you know, if it's glossing over known or over information, like the halacha says that we have to be choshesh for lashon hara. We don't have to accept it and act upon it, but you're required to be choshesh, to be wary of it, that maybe there's something there, and you can't just let a case of possible damage and harm to others go by because it's lashon hara. You have to be, you know, be prudent about it and investigate it very thoroughly and take action as need be. So I 100% agree with you on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I'm glad you agree with me on that. So how do we get that to happen, though? I mean, you know, that's not, you know, you don't have it in the article, but I'm saying, how do you really make that happen, that rabbis, you know, are willing to stand up and talk about other rabbis, perhaps, who are not acting in the most ethical and honest way?
I think that really has to be that when it's been shown that a rabbi did not act ethically and honestly, whether the rabbi did something criminal or violated halacha or both, I think that those rabbis who knew about it and didn't step up or who defended him even more so, they have to be called out on the carpet. I think that's the only way this will really be taken care of. So you don't have this idea in people's minds like, well, he was my chavrus in yeshiva. I know him from beforehand. He's a rabbi in a neighboring town. How can I say anything about him? No, everyone's accountable, and you're accountable to community to speak up if you feel there's something, you know, amiss with a rabbi, another rabbi.
Right. I mean, one of the issues that have come up over the years also, you know, you talk about, let's say, the rabbi's discretionary fund, the pulpit fund. And, you know, there's been, you know, some abuse, but certainly, as you said, you know, the vast, vast majority of rabbis are beyond reproach, absolutely 100%. But, you know, there have been cases and documented cases, and I think maybe one of the things that has to happen, even though it's unpleasant, but sometimes someone has to say to the rabbi, look, you know, you need two signatures, and you need people on your committee, people who you trust, people who you know are going to hold things in confidence, but you can't do this on your own, because after a while, it's really almost like a lift naiver when you sit there and nobody's watching you for all those years. Who knows what happens?
I agree 100%. I would add one more thing also. The whole idea of the discretionary fund, it's one thing to have the rabbi in charge of certain tzedakah funds, whether, you know, people come into the shul instead of them walking around to every person in the middle of davening. The rabbi, he has a certain fund, he has a certain box of whether bills, and he can come and give it. That's one thing. But really, the whole, really sort of viewing it in the line of the thrust of my article is that maybe the rabbi, not because we don't trust him, but maybe having the rabbi as a money manager, maybe that's not really something we should be looking for. Not because we don't trust him, again, just because that is sort of putting him into a sphere that's not purely rabbinic, and it's just basically, if the rabbi has a proclivity for the wrong thing, it's basically asking for problems. Why should, you know? I don't really see the point of it, to be honest.
So let's say the charity fund or the discretionary fund, would we be better off in a way where if there was a small committee that everybody knew, or the people in the community who people really trusted, and it was a small committee, and they were in charge of that. And the rabbi didn't have to really, rabbi could go and he could obviously, you know, talk to them about situations, but they would handle it. They would handle the money part. They would take care of the whole thing so that it wouldn't be within his domain.
Exactly right. Again, not because we don't trust him, just because it's not something that's a rabbinic duty. We don't find in the Gemara that we had the gadoi tzedakah, people who are in charge of tzedakah funds, and we don't find that was the rabbi. The rabbis of the Talmud were not the ones they gave tzedakah. Maybe they helped people with tzedakah. They maybe asked tzedakah causes to help other individuals, but they were not the ones in charge of mass funds. They're not money managers. It's not something really out of convenience. Maybe it's a good thing to have the rabbi in charge, but really, ideally, I don't see why the rabbi should be in charge of that more than he should be in charge of scheduling the seating for the high holidays. It's not really within this, you know, within this purview, which really detracts from, I think, the holiness of the rabbinic focus.
Right. Now, that would be that's an interesting point. I don't know. Do you know of any shuls that do that? I don't know personally.
I'm going to give you an example. I'm saying just like a shul would never put the rabbi in charge of the seating, so too, why should the rabbi be in charge of managing the money or be in charge of printing brochures or whatever? It's not inherently a rabbinic duty. And why I don't know why that suddenly, why that discretionary fund has become part of the rabbi's purview, whereas it really is no more part of a religious function than the other things that are not part of his purview.
Okay, then you say, you know, act the part. Now, are you saying that, do you think that every rabbi should always be dressed? And I mean, I know rabbis who I've been with, you know, on trips, you know, we'll go traveling in Israel and we'll do hiking in the mountains, and they're wearing their black suit and their tie and their white shirt. I mean, where do you kind of walk? What's the line? You know, like you're coming to your kid's Little League game or something like that. I mean, you know, you don't expect them to wear shorts and a, you know, but what is it? Just like to dress in a dignified way? Is that what it is?
Yeah, dignified within the context. If the context is you're going hiking, the Rebbe, let's say, is taking his high school boys hiking. So let's say, so he's not going to wear, you know, he shouldn't be wearing maybe a Budweiser T-shirt or something like that, a pair of cutoffs. He shouldn't be wearing a suit either. But let him dress in the dignified way. As a hiker, within that context, therefore, there's always a certain sense of, you know, he's our Rebbe. He's the one to look up to. We aspire to be like him. He has a certain sense of, I guess, you know, Torah or holiness about him, you know, that elevates us. I think that's really the vision. So within the context, not in an objective way, the rabbi should wear a three-piece suit to a tennis game or something.
You think it's a good idea for rabbis to be eating in people's houses, the congregants' houses? Do you think, I know some rabbis that have the policy, you know, they just eat in their own house and makes it easy and so on.
I think it's a very good policy that they shouldn't. I agree with you on that 100%. I think they should not be eating in people's houses. It's one thing if the person maybe, like in my neighborhood, a few of the rabbis have relatives, close relatives, who are also congregants. So maybe that's different because, say, you know, inviting them for Shabbos or something. But if the person is not a clear relative situation, I really don't think it's a good idea. It's only asking for trouble.
Okay, right. And then you talk about raising everyone up through Torah. So what do you mean by that?
I mean that if the rabbi, if he is seen as a Torah personality, if he's focused, if he uses his spare time to learn Torah, people see him involved in Torah, involved in mitzvahs, then I think that he can, and the programming is centered around Torah as much as possible, then he can really raise up, set an example and set standards and have events that raise up the entire community to be excelling in Torah learning and observance of mitzvahs, so the whole community can become really elevated through the rabbi, through his example and through the programming that he sets in place. It's really up to him.
Okay, that sounds good. So, I mean, the article really, you know, covers a lot, and I think we've covered a lot in our little discussion. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you've made some really good suggestions, and I like those suggestions, and I think that if we did that, perhaps it would help the situation. But unfortunately, like you said, you know, one bad story, and then, you know, everything else is out the window because that's all you hear about over and over and over and over again. But I think maybe rabbis should learn from that. I mean, hopefully the rabbis today are learning from what happened in the past, just the recent past, and make sure they're not in that situation as far as counseling and who they meet and when they meet them and what happens and other things like that. They've got to really take precautions to make sure that no one at all is going to question anything they do at all. They have to be beyond.
Right, exactly. Maybe I can make one more point based upon that.
Sure, please.
People shouldn't view this article as the antidote to rabbinic scandals. This article was not written in order to say, well, how do we prevent rabbis from getting involved in these terrible things, whether they're moral crimes, financial crimes, whatever it is. This article is not going to address. People have proclivities. People have pathological issues. That's a separate thing for professionals. This article, basically, the way it started is that I was sort of thinking when I was reading about these scandals or alleged scandals, whatever you want to call them, I was thinking that, you know, people are focusing upon the legalities, the halachic aspects that are important. Did the rabbi actually cross this boundary? Did he not? But I was saying, let's take a step back. So the rabbi in the first place, forgetting about legalities and halachic, is this even appropriate, this the image for a rabbi to be involved in such a thing, even in a very legal way? And that's what got me thinking. But just one more second on mine, please, is that I apologize saying it that way. But I think that, and what happened really is that I just sort of put pen to paper. I write for a website, Cross Currents, and I wrote a short piece about this, and then I'm also on the Jewish Action Editorial Committee, and Nechama Carmel, who's an excellent editor, but also out-of-the-box, really creative person, she saw my article, and she said, you know what, there's so much more there that you can develop and cultivate for Jewish Action.
Right.
So that's really how this came about. So it's really not addressing the scandals, but addressing, taking a step back, and that's something that's important to focus on.
Wonderful. Listen, Rabbi Gordimer, always a pleasure. Continue your great work. We've been talking to Rabbi Avraham Gordimer, who's a rabbinic coordinator at the Orthodox Union. And thank you so much for the article and for everything you do. Be well. Have a great day.
Do you have a great day. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.